sometimes we look for something in the Bible and find what we're looking for and miss some of the things that's there. I understand that there was a Bible study in Esther last week. I heard. And I hope that what we're going to do today is going to be a little different from what did happen last week. The theme or the emphasis of what I'm hoping that we accomplish this morning is grappling with what community is all about. And there are some pretty solid, there is some pretty solid information in Esther about community. I'm going to ask volunteers, whoever wants to volunteer, to read some pieces. Let's begin with Esther 1, verses 15 to 22. And if you feel like reading, just read.
According to the law, what is to be done to Queen Vashti because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuch? Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the princes, not only to the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but also to all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For this deed of the queen will be made known to all women, causing them to look with contempt upon their husbands, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will be telling it to all the king's princes, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. If it please the king, let a royal order go forth from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, so that it may not be altered, that Vashti is to come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, vast as it is, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low. How far?
22.
This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be lord in his own house and speak according to the language of his people.
Well, well, well. Seems to me that there's a conflict getting started right off the top. What kinds of things are contributing to this conflict? Vashti did not come.
There's a third person that's giving advice.
Yes. Absolutely.
Their cultural point of view.
Yes, very much so.
Not fear.
Tremendous amount of fear going on. Who's afraid? The men are getting a little scared there. What's the ramifications if they allow this to go the way it's happened?
They'll all act in the same way that the queen acted, and that could not be acceptable.
So it looks like a rebellion's getting started, doesn't it? A sit-in or a protest movement, however you want to call it. But it looks like something very, very significant has to be nipped in the bud. There is some conflict culturally going to get started. Remember, I don't know how many of you were here, but last night I alluded to the fact that some people think that there's a woman's culture and a man's culture. And that's just because we do things differently. But that's part of what's coming into conflict here right now. Vashti is saying, I will not be obedient. I refuse to be obedient. I beg your pardon? Sounds good to me. But there's...
See, what's kind of interesting about this is that practically every culture has some occurrence like this. I'm thinking of Lysistrata in the Greek culture. You know, practically every culture has an occurrence of this kind that happens at some point as part of their oral tradition of the history of their people.
Mm-hmm. And part of what I'm wondering, and I'm not going to pretend to have all the answers now. I may be a pastor, but I don't have all the answers. I hope you can teach me some of the answers, as a matter of fact. But part of what I think we need to think through is the difference between these Medes and Persians. This, we called him King A this morning earlier, just to make it a little easier on the tongue. King A was the king from India to Ethiopia. How much of the Jewish faith, Jewish spirituality, Jewish religion, have influenced that area? How much of their religion was causing that to occur that way? And we just don't have the information about that. But that, I wonder if there are differences between the way men and women interact. There are differences in different cultures. And I wonder how much of that is there too. And Vashti just threw up her hands and said, I can't. There comes a point which you just can't do it anymore. And the king had summoned her. It's the comparable situation that I would think of in the 1960s would be Rosa Parks getting on the bus and saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. I am tired. And something like that happens and it mushrooms or snowballs. I don't mean to mix metaphors here. But it starts and the momentum picks up. And so the best thing to do is nip it in the bud before it can really get started, because before you know it, you have a revolution on your hands. And let's face it, the men want to be honored and obeyed in this scripture. Okay, let's move along. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 8. Chapter 2, verses 1 to 8.
After these things, when the anger of King A had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be brought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the capital, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their ointments be given them. And let the maiden who kisses the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He had brought up Hadasha, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was beautiful and lovely, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai adopted her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many maidens were gathered in Susa, the capital, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women.
Okay, and then let's read 15 through 18.
When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except that Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advise. Now Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her, and when Esther was taken to King A into his royal palace in the 10th month which is the month of Tebeth, in the seventh year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet to all his princes and servants. It was Esther's banquet. He also granted a remission of the taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal liberality.
Thank you. Esther, before she even got into the king's presence, had spent 12 months under the regulations for the women, and then this 12 months was the regular period of their beautifying. 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, and then some more time just getting acclimated, I suppose, to living in the palace and everything that entailed. So there was a year's period at least between the time Esther was brought to the palace and before she had gotten an audience with the king. What kinds of issues do you see in this section? And I'm not talking about men-women issues now. What kinds of cross-cultural issues do we see in this section that have the potential of tremendous conflict?
Trying to be Jewish when they're kids in a non-Jewish place.
Yeah. And that is serious conflict.
Also, when you say a period of beautifying, it makes me think of a part of the discussion last night, and by whose standards? In other words, she's Jewish in a non-Jewish environment, so for whose standards are they beautifying her? Are they accepting her as she is and highlighting and enhancing her own particular ethnic beauty, or are they forcing her to be, you know, the ethnic beauty of that woman?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Serious question here.
Yeah. I think it's quite clear. No woman is accepted in where she is.
Because all the women that they picked up in their journeys through the land had to go through this 12-month period.
But it's probably a physical sense of beautification. I don't think, in my opinion, it probably isn't such a beautiful.
All the outward extensions of the person were probably, yeah, that's kind of what it
said. Queen Vashti had refused to do, as we talked about in the first chapter, was to allow herself to be paraded before the king to show off her beauty.
Mm-hmm. At the king's summons.
At the king's summons.
Yeah. Cheerleaders.
Also, even though it's not stated, I think of a very practical consideration. It's not that they don't trust these women or virgins. However, if someone is not, and they keep them there for 12 months, they ensure that nobody's pregnant. You know, in other words, to pass off an ear from someone else as an ear of the king. So you keep them in the seclusion for 12 months, and then you ensure after that period of time that any issue that comes from any mating with the king is the king's child.
Yeah, it does.
It's very discriminatory against women. They don't trust them. They don't trust them to really be there.
Well, they don't trust the men either.
They
because
don't trust the men either. Yeah, I mean, they're going to be pregnant by you. I'm going to distrust your period. Any human being.
Crazy, just trust.
Yeah. All of that. Anything else? What other things do you see? One of the things that we talked about in the early session, do you all remember college mixers? When the men stood around the walls and the women paraded through and the men checked the women out and acceptability had something to do with whether or not a man approached you and asked you to dance. And we talked about that being kind of the scene of this. You know, they were called from all over the country and brought together, and then after being properly coached, and somebody mentioned the word brainwashed, probably, about how to act in the palace and what you do and what you don't do and how you carry yourself and what perfume you wear and so forth and so on. After that experience, then they went to the mixer. And in this case, it's Esther who stands out above and beyond all the other women. She had some beauty of her own that was just imbued in her. They still did not know that she was Jewish at this point. That was between her and Mordecai. What do you think Mordecai was about? Why would Mordecai push her up in this position, knowing that they had been deported and made their lives in this place, and here pushing one of the Jewish people who were aliens to become the queen? What could Mordecai possibly have been thinking?
Favors for his people?
Possibly.
What else?
Power in someone.
Power in someone?
Maybe the survival.
Whose survival?
The survival of Jewish people. Mm-hmm.
Mordecai's own.
Mordecai's survival himself? Say that louder.
Esther's survival.
In other words, God set the stage just about. And Mordecai, I assume Mordecai, being an alert person, was able to use the stage that God set in behalf of the community. Mordecai was allowed by God to be in a position to do something.
Cheryl, do you mind thinking of, I think of some of the stories that I've read of slave mothers and the kinds of things that they would do to help a child survive and possibly get out of that environment, because that was going to be, you know, that was going to be like their salvation, one person removed. You know what I mean? And so this is kind of, to me, this is kind of the same type of story.
Kind of like Moses, too.
Yeah.
And Miriam pushing Moses off in the bushes in order for him to survive as one of the children who will pass on the values, traditions, keep the community alive. And that's kind of what Mordecai was doing too. In chapter 3, it basically talks about Haman, who was one of the king's advisors, very, very close to King A. And Haman, who had a real ego problem. I don't know how else to say that. He had a tremendous ego, and he expected that everybody would worship him in a funny kind of way. And he came to the gates, and Mordecai refused to bow down and acknowledge Haman's power and potential. And Haman got incensed at that. He could not handle the fact that somebody said no to him. And it's very interesting to note that when you say no to somebody, how angry they can get. Has anybody ever experienced that? Somebody wanting you to do something and you say no? Like a child maybe wanting to do something and you say no as a parent, and they have a temper tantrum and try and be evil and mean and do everything they can to let you know that they really did not like your answer? Have you?
I think of the movie The Color Purple.
Mm-hmm.
And that lady refused to be amazed. And what happened to her was years of punishment.
That's right. We say that the most powerful word in the English language is no. That's what Rosa Parks did when she sat down on that bus. She simply said no. That's what women did. That's what Vashti did. She said no. And you see what happened? They upset the whole kingdom because one woman said no. And that's kind of what rebellions are all about. And
people in South Africa are saying no.
That's right.
People in Nicaragua, if you think of that image of what makes Nicaragua so dangerous, this little tiny country, but it's saying no.
That's right. And you know, either you nip it in the bud, as they did Vashti, or be prepared for all out and out rebellion, war, however you want to look at it. But that's what's going to happen. And that's what happened to Haman now. Somebody told him no. And he was probably not accustomed to anybody ever telling him no. And so he decided he was going to go plotting behind the backs of Mordecai and Esther, still not realizing that they were even related, he went and plotted to wipe out the entire Jewish nation because one man said no. The entire Jewish nation in Persia and Media. Everybody got wiped out. And the king didn't know what he was up to. So the king went and stamped his seal of approval on it, and so all this was planned. And then Mordecai found out about it. And Mordecai sent a messenger to Esther to inform Esther of what was going on. And I'm going to read the middle of the end of chapter 4, and that brings us up to date. Chapter 4, I'll read 11 through 17. No, I'm sorry, that was the wrong page. 11 through 17. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces knew that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter, that they may live. And I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. Then they told Mordecai what Esther had said. Then Mordecai told them to return answer to Esther, think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to this kingdom for such a time as this. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a feast on my behalf and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, day or night. I and my maids will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. For such a time as this.
Pretty bad time when the king can prove genocide for the whole nation.
Mm-hmm.
And that really was not characteristic of the Persian Empire.
I wonder
why he accepted that.
I'd hazard a guess that he just didn't know what he was doing. That he trusted Haman so much that there are people that you trust.
Yeah, in chapter 3, the verse says that Haman gave him 10,000 talents for proving his wife and mouth.
Money
chapter
talks.
Chapter 3, verse 9.
Money talks. And also he didn't... I know he did not know that Esther and Mordecai were Jews either. So as a consequence, he didn't realize that he was wiping out his queen's entire community. Or he had given permission for the entire community to be wiped out.
But why would he do that for any community, even apart from all of that?
I guess $10,000. Or 10,000 talents.
No, but the talents were to carry out the business.
Let's look at chapter 3, verse 9. Haman said, there is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws, so that it is not for the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries. So the king took his signet ring and gave it to Haman, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you.
Yeah, I read that as being $10 million for the contract.
For the contract. I think that's probably a very good analogy.
Well, I think you also hear, I mean, as the Huerez is kind of portrayed all the way through here so far as being a rather incredible bumbler as a king. I mean, he's a man who has rather limited knowledge of what his advisors are up to.
He trusts them.
Rather less interest. Yeah.
It's almost as if he puts implicit trust in them, and they can run the bus over him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are we doing this, or are we allowed to relate this to Rainbow on the Mountaintop theme?
This is your... let me say something. This is your Bible study. I just happen to be facilitating it. Wherever it goes, it goes.
Okay, I'd like to point out the contradiction between this, because even though what Mordecai did was hardly a mortal sin, yet he did do something specific to warrant some kind of action being taken against him, even though it was sort of out of touch with what is reasonable. However, so I relate that back to the black experience in this country, who did nothing to precipitate their slavery. And where I'm going, I mean, in other words, I'm saying they suffered because of that, and yet they didn't precipitate that by any action on their own. In this case, even though the reaction to the action is unreasonable, yet Mordecai did do something to precipitate some kind of action being taken against him. And so
he
I'm
didn't,
just
he didn't. He didn't.
He refused to bow down.
No.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, he refused to bow down.
But it was not the Persian Median custom to require this kind of obedience. One of the strengths of the Persian Empire was that they tolerated and actively promoted the ethnic religious practices. Yeah.
But the decree to bow down to Haman was enacted.
Was new.
Yeah, but it was enacted.
Yeah.
And he refused to do it. So I'm saying, even though with the reaction to his action was unreasonable.
Okay,
yet,
I hear what you're saying.
But what I'm comparing that to is the people that were forced into slavery in this country through no action or fault on their own.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I see is Mordecai was carried into slavery. Yeah, pardon? Like I say, all
the people carried there because they didn't go there because they wanted to. They
had all been deported. I think everybody does. I think we do. I think people do hope. And it's an interesting comparison. Let's get back to Esther and Mordecai. There's a whole lot of community information in this. Esther, when she finds out what Haman is plotting, realizes she cannot just sit on the throne. There comes a point at which you've got to take some action. She has been very comfortable in the palace. She's been clothed and fed and perfumed and massaged and, you know, everything that one could desire, but everything is still not right. And when her uncle Mordecai, her father's surrogate, uncle cousin, comes to her and tells her what's going on, she makes an immediate decision. After consulting with him, she makes a decision. She knows that it is death to walk into the king's chambers without being summoned. And she is taking a risk that he will acknowledge her. What's at stake? Why is she willing to take that kind of risk?
I think it's Mordecai's prophetic statement. Where I think, her initial response is not to take that risk. It's to secure the appropriate benefits for Mordecai.
Okay.
And then he makes this powerful statement of faith. Hey, you've got the chance to save Israel. If you don't do it, your family's going to die and somebody else will save Israel.
Okay.
God has put you there for a purpose. Now let's do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then she makes that wonderful jump.
That's right. For such a time as this, Mordecai says, you've been placed here. What? I really want us to talk about community. And what am I thinking? I'm thinking that Esther could have very easily said, hey, I am comfortable. Y'all fight your own battles, and the king really loves me, and as a consequence, I will be safe. The whole family may be wiped out, but the king loves me. And Haman can't touch me because I am the queen. Esther could have very easily said that. Esther could have very easily been individualistically approaching this whole thing. Very, very easily.
I think one thing it says about community is that blood is thicker than water. Let's put it that way. that the love for your people, attachment to your people, to your community, often supersedes other personal attachments, interpersonal relationships. And it's always there, always there.
That community has to be more important than you.
For the community to survive, the community will have to be something larger than you, something much more important than you.
However, I would say that has been superseded by Baptist community in the New Testament, so that now water is the given word. Because we create a community in Christ by our baptism into Christ. And so I see that that's a stronger connection now.
Well, on the other hand.
Well, no, I'm just saying, I'm just saying for the sake of faith, you know.
On the other hand, baptized people have been washed in the blood of the Lamb.
Depends upon what blood is strongest, okay? Well, I'm glad we resolved that one. But, okay, let's get back to the community. What? Why was it so important to save this community? Because they were children of the promise, God's children. They were the remnant. They were also the remnant. And that's the other reason it was real important. They were the remnant. And eventually they were able to move back. But that was what was left over. What can we, other than the blood of the Lamb and the water of baptism, what other applications can we draw into 1987?
She draws on the strength of the people outside of her situation. She asks them to pray and fast for her.
That's right.
While she does it inside, so it's sort of solidarity in the palace and outside the palace.
And that's what King did in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. That's a real solid connection. Everybody, what King asked was that the Church of Christ pray and be united in the struggle for civil rights.
Is that what he's asked of us now? The church, as Christians, as our statement of faith that we cannot tolerate the situation in South Africa?
I think that that's what the South African Christians are asking global Christians to do, yes. To be in solidarity, to pray, to do what you can, yeah.
To say no.
To say no to the demonic. That's right.
But probably constant remnants, if you think of the Jews, the killings of Jews, that there were voices that may have been raised, Bonhoeffer, men who raised voices, but they're not heard. Last day, was killed, but Esther survived, even though she was not as part of the community, however, but said no.
Mm-hmm.
But here, the other one I would relate to might be related to Martin Luther King in the sense there were voices that were constantly calling, but this voice finally emerged as one of the strongest voices ever to come across our country. And I suppose that we can cite that if you want an example today, in South Africa, that would be true too, that there are voices that are coming up. And some day, we hope soon, a voice will be heard that calls either South Africa and the global community for an action that will be
made. How about
Desmond
Tutu? That's a possibility. And I think the key words are Mordecai's here, for such a time as this. God is the one who has prepared. It's you know, reflect back on Joseph. God placed Joseph in Egypt so that the people would survive when there was a famine in the land. If Joseph had not been in Egypt and had put away food and grain and so forth and so on for the famine, no one would have survived. And so God takes what people mean for evil and demonic purposes, turns it around and makes it good for such times when it is absolutely crucial for God's people. And I think that that's what you're saying. That's what we're all saying. That's what Esther, or this Bible story, is telling us. And I think that that is as applicable today in 1987 as it was 1,500 years or however long before Christ is appeared.
I think it's important that we see that it wasn't just Esther and Mordecai, but the Jews who were under threat of annihilation, that they were fasting, they were resisting. And I think we have a tendency oftentimes to want heroes and heroes to solve our problems rather than deepen our own commitments. And I think that the lesson of this for me is not only what was happening at the palace, but also what was happening outside, that people were resisting.
That God had put some leaders there, but this was the people that were involved with it. There were some leaders that God had placed in positions of responsibility and accountability and authority. But if the people had not been holding up these leaders and you know, expressing to them that they did need their leadership in for survival, then they would have been Lone Rangers.
We're not all leaders. We can't all be leaders, fortunately. And we're not called to be leaders. We're not called necessarily even maybe to be successful, but we are called by God to be faithful, to say no regardless of the consequences.
Okay.
And that's what faithfulness means. To say no regardless, to say no to the divine, to say yes to the justice.
That's what struck me about her answer. She said, if I go in and I perish, so be it. If I go in and God delivers me, then praise God. And that's sort of like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego.
Mm-hmm.
If we're delivered, okay, but we're going to go through with it anyway. And that's a tremendous amount of commitment. I mean, sort of one thing to calculate a successful strategy and then, you know, move towards it, you know, counting your chickens, and it's another to go in not knowing
what's going to happen.
That's
right. But that's what that young lady was saying in Matins this morning, reading about faith.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important in South Africa, because any leader that just keeps his head up above the horizon is shot and killed instantly.
Mm-hmm.
So that will really be interesting for the people to take hold of, to be faithful rather than just upholding the leader, because the leaders won't be.
And the people have to protect the leader, too. The leader isn't out there all by him or herself. The people must protect the leader if their survival is to be ensured.
And it's not just South Africa. It's in the inner cities here. It's on the family farm. It's dealing with Nicaragua. It's dealing with nuclear weapons. It's not the leaders that are going to make a difference. It's the faithful us.
Amen.
The faithful
us.
Right. Us.
Amen.
Not them, but us.
See, I feel that the most important point that I'm seeing is that Mordecai had a vision, and he prepared before that happens, and that's our problem, that we do not prepare, we do not try to foresee what is next month or next year. But Mordecai saw that.
Yeah.
He knew that he worked on Esther. He prepared. Preparation.
Mm-hmm.
We do not prepare. And when things happen sometimes, we don't have, like Mordecai had an answer. He already, because he had that vision before.
That makes a whole lot of sense, and last night probably brought it home to all of us when the children did Vespers. That those are the ones who must be prepared to lead us. Because we're not getting any younger. And if we haven't done the job of grooming them to step into the position of leadership, then we are remiss. And we are the problem, not them.
And if I heard you right, you think something else also, that Mordecai was aware that the problem was going to arise.
He read
too often, we are, no matter how prepared we are, for we're not aware that the problem is going to come. The problem when it arises, take the spices dry.
It's too late.
And yeah. I never thought this would happen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Huh? I'm sure we've all said that at one point or another.
So vision, I think that there's some people in our country that have that vision. And many of us do not listen to them because we said, why is he saying this? What grounds does he have?
Mm-hmm.
But it happens over and over and over. Some of our leaders have that vision. But do we back them up?
Sometimes we fight them because we don't like the vision that they have, and we think that the vision's wrong. And so we do everything we can to fight against that vision, and therefore nobody is prepared. And that's...
George Washington said, where there is no vision, the people perish.
George Washington said that? I thought it was something biblically. I thought that was something in the Bible. Without a vision, the people perish. No, that's very true. And I think that the challenge to us this next week on this mountaintop is, what is our vision as a multicultural people? And what are we willing to do in order for that vision to become reality? What are we doing to prepare the way? What are we saying no to? What are we willing to let loose in order that that vision may come about?
We're all willing to go without food for 3 days. Griped about the right. So often in the Bible, they ask us to fast and pray. And how willing are we to do it?
How willing are we to pray? Much less fast and pray. But in the 60s, some of the black leaders did that. They fasted and prayed for 3, 5, 7 days prior to getting involved with a particular march or a particular demonstration or getting thrown in a particular jail. And that was a way of purifying themselves, getting out the ego, letting the ego go and letting God in, so that the control would not be in their hands but in God. So that is something that is not just biblical, it's not just done in biblical times, but it has been done recently and it still continues to be done. That happens with Native American spirituality. They will go on vision quests without food, without water, and to do so is to engage the Great Spirit, to hear what the Great Spirit is telling you, to go in the direction the Great Spirit is leading you.
It strikes me too that Mordecai's attitude is very gospel-oriented. Because he was willing to give up the whole Jewish law, the interaction with Gentiles, and eating laws, and all of that for him and Esther. He wasn't bound by the tradition, by the law. But he was willing to sacrifice that for the greater good of saving the people.
For the survival of the community.
Reminds me of Paul. And if we would give up his own salvation, it's cost the salvation of others.
Would we give up our Lutheranism?
That's the next question. That's a serious question. I think that's something we have to examine within ourselves. I'm not going to ask for confessions this morning. But that there's a lot of denominationalism that occurs, which is not good. There's some there's some Lutheranism that's good. But a lot of it is not good. One of the things that I cannot do at Loop College is talk about Lutheranism. I've got to talk about Christianity because the population is so diverse. And sometimes I can't even talk about Christianity. I've got to talk about being a religious person. Whatever name your God goes by. Because again, of the religious diversity on the campus, that's a challenge. That is really a challenge.
And also taking into thought to another area, a lot of ethnocentrism within the Lutheran Church that still is locked to some people getting together. So that my being German is more important than my being Christian.
That's right. That does happen. And what we're about this week, hopefully, is saying that being a German Lutheran is as good as being a Norwegian Lutheran, which is as good as being a Hispanic Lutheran or a Black Lutheran or an Asian Lutheran or a Native American Lutheran. And we all bring gifts that God has given us to this table of Lutheranism. And Lutheranism can only be enriched by the diversity of gifts, God is, has in God's goodness and wisdom bestowed. You all feel okay with this? It's a challenge. It's really a challenge. There's a lot of power in this book of the Bible. Tremendous amount of power. It's almost like a fairy tale because at the end it is kind of a happily ever after ending. Because the Jews are saved. King A is Mordecai. Talks him into rescinding his order for the annihilation of the Jewish nation. Mordecai is elevated to Haman's position, and Haman's is hanged on the gallows that he had erected for Mordecai. I mean, everything turns out nice in the end. It's almost like a fairy tale. It doesn't say they lived happily ever after. That's not real life. There is no such thing, I'm convinced, as happily ever after. There's more struggle, more challenge, more pain, more demands, more courage, all of the above. And we can only get that from being in community. Because it is in community that we are strengthened and renewed and re-energized to go out there and continue to say no and to struggle and to keep on keeping on. And that's where you also get the little last bit of energy to come back into community to get revitalized. I don't have a watch. I hate to be so mundane here in the middle of this. 8 minutes too, okay. Any closing comments that you might have? We've got 8 minutes for closing comments.
I think it's interesting that so many things, good things that happen are initiated by the women.
Always have. Men don't do so bad themselves sometimes. There are. No, but it's very interesting that in history, God does not choose a gender to favor. God never has.
Well, I haven't noticed that.
You haven't? Who says that? Joanna? You think God has favored a gender?
I do.
You think God has favored?
Man.
That's another Bible study. But I think history has favored men, male. I don't know that God has.
Well, as representatives of God, then, that are 99.4% pure white and male clergy leaders in the Lutheranism, for example, I don't think it's God ordained, but having the permissiveness of it has ended in the same sort of results until the last 15 years.
Is that God's fault or is that
Oh,
human fault?
Obviously it's human, but if one looks at it historically, it certainly looks God.
Stephen, what we can do is we can look upon the new church as really a new opportunity to change all that.
Yeah, right. And look at what all the things have done.
Yeah, I know.
I think that...
For such a time as this.
Yes.
So there's certainly the time for it, but you've got to get the new Lutheran church thinking
new
in relation to gender, economics, gender, race, sexual preferences. All of those have to be a part
of new ways of thinking.
If it is going to indeed be new, and the old cliques just gather differently and combine themselves together in a different kind of an alliance, it still deals in the cliques of society, the cliques of holding, the cliques of
whatever. That's up to us, too.
Yeah.
To continually say no.
Yeah.
No.
That's up to us. But that's why we have daily battles. It's not really the big Esther battle that we're involved in. It's right here today at 10 in the coffee, at 4, at 7, at 9, that each person has to be involved in the lives and the community of Newman.
We have a pastor in Chicago.
Or, yeah.
We have a pastor in Chicago who says the name has changed, but the game is the same. And that's too true, and I think that what we have to do is change the game plan.
Roberta,
closing comments. Behind every good man, there's a good woman to fight.
That's
behind every good woman, there's a good man.